besiege Gaza Strip, first major reprieve in over 7 weeks of conflict in the coastal sliver. After prolonged negotiations, ceasefire came into force at 7 a.m. That's Gaza time on Friday, which is 0500 GMT. Start of the truce is said to be followed by a prisoner swap between the Israeli regime and Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in about 7 hours' time from now. The brief hiatus in the war comes as the Tel Aviv regime's onslaught on Gaza has killed nearly 15,000 Palestinians and displaced countless more. Israel's relentless strikes on civilian areas, including homes, schools, and hospitals, have drawn worldwide condemnation. Most countries and international bodies have denounced the regime's acts as war crimes and genocide.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has agreed to a four-day humanitarian truce in the Gaza Strip. The movement says the truce, mediated by Qatar and Egypt, includes exchange of Israeli captives with Palestinian prisoners held by the regime. Hamas said in a statement 50 Israeli captives, all women and children, will be released in exchange for the freedom of 150 Palestinian women and children. Under the agreement, hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid, including fuel and medicine, will be brought to all areas of the Gaza Strip. During the truce, the Israeli regime is to refrain from arresting or attacking anyone all across the besieged Palestinian territory. Also, air traffic will completely stop during the truce in the southern Gaza Strip. In the north, however, air traffic will stop for 6 hours a day.
Truce will be significant for humanitarian aid because it will allow for a large number of humanitarian aid trucks and convoys to enter the Gaza Strip. But I must add that the number of humanitarian aid or the amount of that aid that's going to be allowed in is nowhere close to what was the regular, let's say, flow of humanitarian and aid.
Israel's cabinet has also voted in favor of the agreement. The war cabinet has reportedly been split on the issue for weeks. Some hardline figures believe that Israel's relentless bombing of the Gaza Strip was the best way to weaken Hamas and to free the captives. Others believe that Israel must get what it can now, however unsatisfactory.
Israel is failing military, and that's why it's in agony, and it wants a ceasefire to reset, because its ground invading forces are failing on the ground.
Since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught on Palestinians on the 7th of October, the regime has sought to dismantle the resistance groups there. However, resistance have turned Gaza into a quagmire for Israeli troops, forcing the regime into redefining its objectives.
The agreement would reflect a change of course by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet. Right from the beginning of the war, Netanyahu announced that he was pursuing two main objectives from the war. The regime was trying to isolate and eliminate Hamas by destroying its military and governing capabilities. Netanyahu also promised to protect Israel from Gaza-based threats and attacks. Furthermore, he said his cabinet would free the captives without compromising with Hamas resistance movement. None of those objectives have been realized. Hamas has suffered some casualties, but its military capabilities, including its network of bunkers and tunnels, as well as its ability to launch retaliatory attacks on Israel forces, have largely been left untouched. Hamas and the resistance ideology is deeply rooted in the hearts and minds of Palestinian people in Gaza. Netanyahu had to abandon its uncompromising stance with regards to the captives. His cabinet was ultimately forced to strike a deal with Hamas in order to free them.
Well, absolutely. I don't think that the Israelis would have accepted to go into this kind of a truce without being dealt devastating blows by the resistance and by Hamas. Of course, the Israelis found themselves unable to achieve anything on ground, and they saw that this is a good thing for them to do. They are not doing it for the sake of humanity.
We can see from their statements in the Israeli Knesset that any truce would be a concession, and that proves that they have achieved nothing. But that's not enough. Despite the truce, all forms of resistance must continue.
Netanyahu's shift may have been critically influenced by his personal encounter with captives' families after weeks of refusal to meet them. Netanyahu and his Likud party have lost the trust and confidence of most voters.
Left! 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 Left!
We gather here in request that the one to be blamed is our prime minister, that he has to go down and leave his office and let another government to rule in Israel and try to make it better.
Internationally, the regime has also come under immense pressure. Thousands of people have held countless rallies against the Israeli regime and its bloodbath in Gaza, and calls war growing to refer Israel's genocide in Gaza to international criminal court.
Palestinians in the city of Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, have welcomed a truce taking effect in the besieged territory. Let's take a listen to comments by some of the residents there.
It is true that everyone is very happy that there is a truce and a ceasefire, but the issue is that we, the residents of the north, were uprooted because of the bombardment, and we won't be able to go back to our homes. This is tragic. We want to go to see our homes, see the martyrs and the injured, see our children that we've left behind. We hope that this truce is extended and that everyone goes back to their homes.
It would be better if the truce lasts and conditions go back to what they were, and people go back to their land and homes. Whoever lost their home, may God compensate them. May those martyred rest in peace, and may the injured recover. This applies to myself and others.
May God bring what is best, and that is not just a truce, but a ceasefire that lasts. May God bring calm between people, enough with the destruction of homes. People's homes collapsed. They were displaced and left in a panic. They lost their houses, their money, and their property.
Head of the Political Bureau of Hamas says that a truce deal with Israel is a result of victory of resistance fighters in the battlefield.
This is a political victory achieved through resistance in the battlefield. The enemy has failed to achieve any of its goals except massacring women, children, and citizens and destroying their homes.
Hania added that U.S. is the main protagonist behind Israel's war on Gaza. The Hamas chief also thanked Iranians, especially leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, for supporting Palestinians during the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza. Hania was speaking in a meeting with Iran's foreign minister in Qatar. Hossein Amir Abdollahian reaffirmed Iran's strong determination to continue supporting the Palestinian nation and resistance. Earlier, the top Iranian diplomat had issued a stern warning to Israel as he met with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, in Doha.
If the Israeli regime continues the war following this phase of the truce, conditions in the region will get out of hand and reactions will become more extensive.
Iran's foreign minister added Israel cannot continue the war without U.S. support. He said attacks on American bases in West Asia are resistance groups' reaction to Washington's support for the regime's genocidal war. Amir Abdollahian also rejected claims about Iran being behind those attacks, stressing that Israel will not be able to eliminate Hamas through military or political means. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Israel was forced to accept the truce due to resistance by Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian protesters continue to hold rallies worldwide in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza as Israel presses ahead with its bloody war. On Thursday, tens of thousands of Cubans marched in front of the U.S. Embassy in the capital, Havana, led by President Miguel Diaz-Canel. They accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. In the U.S., protesters blocked the Thanksgiving Day parade in New York City. Demonstrators chanted slogans while holding Palestinian flags. Elsewhere in the city, hundreds carried placards calling for an end to U.S. military aid to Tel Aviv. A similar protest was held in Melbourne, Australia, where hundreds of students walked out of school calling for an immediate end to Israel's war on Gaza. They also urged their government to stop its military support for Israel. And in Pakistan, thousands of school children rallied in the capital, Islamabad.
In a heartwarming display of empathy and solidarity, thousands of school children from private and public schools across Pakistan gathered at a spirited children's rally to express their support for the Palestinian children facing the harsh realities of Israel's atrocities in Gaza. The event, marked by a sea of youthful faces, echoed with chants of unity and calls for justice.
Here to tell our Palestine sisters and brothers that they are not alone. We are always stand with them and we always raise our voice for them.
I'm here to support Palestine and support kids like me. My message is that the Palestinians shall be free.
These Pakistani children, armed with compassion, stood united to condemn the injustices that Palestinian children face amid the ongoing war in Gaza.
We are here to show our support to the children of Palestine. We stand with them.
I am here to support the Palestinian children and I stand with them.
The rally served as a testament to the power of education in fostering compassion and empathy, transcending geographical boundaries to create a global community that stands against oppression.
Any conflict in which such a big number of children are killed, this is a children's genocide in Gaza, and children around the world are showing solidarity with the children of Gaza. They are angry about the killing because Israel has targeted the children of Gaza specifically.
Children here in Pakistan called for a world in which each and every child's rights are safeguarded and respected.
Through their participation in these pro-Palestine rallies, Pakistani school children not only supported the solidarity narrative, but also reminded the international community of profound resonance of Israel's onslaught on Gaza within the younger generation, which values justice, empathy, and peace. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
An extraordinary and heroic move, the Yemeni army forces seized an Israeli cargo ship in the Red Sea on Sunday in response to the regime's deadly aggression on Gaza. Our correspondent for Iran's Arabic news channel, Al Alam, has visited the detained ship in the Yemeni port and followed this report.
Docking up the Israeli ship, Galaxy Leader, off the coast of Yemen, or even crossing the Red Sea, is not welcome unless mandatory with an invitation. The seizure of ship is in line with this narrative, and the Yemeni forces did it remarkably, displaying support for the Palestinian cause.
I'm standing on the deck of Galaxy Leader, an Israeli ship that was seized by Yemen's naval forces. They did this to help our brother borders in Palestine and to support the Islamic Jihad and other Palestinian resistance movements which are fighting against the tyranny and global arrogance in Israel. This is the first time we stopped this Israeli ship. Through this, we send a message to friends and enemies that the Yemeni naval forces are ready to help our brothers in Gaza with all available means, and they would also make futile any move against the Yemenis.
Yemen's operation that was carried out a few days after the leader's Abdul Malik al-Houthi's speech regarding the constant monitoring of Israeli ships revealed the weakness of the regime's intelligence system once again after the Al-Aqsa flood operation. This operation will continue in the depth of the Red Sea until the regime's attack on Gaza stops.
All Israeli ships will remain the main target of the Yemeni naval forces, and this was only a successful beginning that God has promised to the oppressed, and the Israeli ship exactly fell into the hands of the oppressed.
We are standing on the deck of Galaxy Leader, the first Israeli ship we've seized in defense of our Palestinian brothers. This is not the only ship, and others will follow. We will continue this operation until the attacks on our Palestinian brothers are stopped.
Despite the great shock inflicted on the enemies and the pain of the indifference of the Arab world toward Gaza, Palestinians whose words and action are the same are more valuable to us than anything.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Donald Trump has picked up the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump on Sunday, 19th of November, received the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott for his 2024 presidential bid at a campaign event near the U.S.-Mexico border, a region that has played a pivotal role in the political careers of both Republicans. Greg Abbott, another fierce critic of President Joe Biden's immigration policies, gave Donald Trump an effusive endorsement in Edinburgh, a small city in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, one of the busiest sectors for unlawful border crossings, and an area where Republicans have made inroads with its predominantly Hispanic communities in recent years. After serving meals to Texas National Guard members and troopers involved in the state's border security initiative, known as Operation Lone Star, Donald Trump and Greg Abbott embraced each other on stage, set up in front of Texas law enforcement helicopters, a plane, and an armored vehicle. "We need a president who's going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said. In recent weeks, Donald Trump has escalated his harsh rhetoric on immigration and the scope of his promises on the issue, which some of his advisers believe partially catapulted him to victory over the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2016. In one recent interview, Trump claimed that migrants were poisoning the blood of our country. During his presidency, Donald Trump staged a crackdown on illegal and legal immigration, taking unprecedented actions to cut immigrant admissions, restrict access to the asylum system, build hundreds of miles of border wall, and end temporary deportation protections for hundreds of thousands of immigrants, including those who arrived in the United States as children. But Trump has promised to take his hardline immigration agenda further if he's elected in 2024, pledging to carry out the largest deportation operation in U.S. history, expand his travel bans, deny birthright citizenship to the American-born children of unauthorized immigrants, and reject legal immigrants with political beliefs he disagrees with. Donald Trump has also refused to rule out reviving his infamous migrant family separation policy, which he discontinued in 2018 after a widespread public outcry. Greg Abbott, who has not yet endorsed a presidential candidate, has also made immigration a top issue during his governorship, turning Texas into a chief adversary to Joe Biden's migration and border measures. Since Joe Biden took office, Greg Abbott has ordered state officials to fortify the banks of the Rio Grande with razor wire and river barriers, directed Texas troopers to arrest migrant adults on trespassing charges, and authorized the state to bus tens of thousands of migrants to Democratic-led cities, mainly New York and Chicago. Greg Abbott is also expected to sign what would be the harshest state immigration law in modern American history. The measure, known as SB4, will empower state law enforcement officials to arrest migrants on new illegal entry criminal charges and allow state judges to issue deportation orders to suspected violators. After it passed the Texas legislature earlier this month, the bill was denounced as draconian and unconstitutional by the Mexican government, Democratic lawmakers, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which has promised to challenge the measure in courts of law. SB4 will almost certainly also trigger another legal clash with the Biden administration, as immigration enforcement is a federal responsibility. In recent days, President Biden's re-election campaign has seized on Donald Trump's 2024 immigration promises, casting them as radical and cruel. In a public messaging campaign, it hopes will galvanize Latinos to vote against Trump. Donald Trump has been unapologetically open about the extreme, inhumane, and fundamentally un-American policies that he would enact if he found his way back into the Oval Office. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, President Biden's campaign manager, said at a press briefing on Saturday. Joe Biden faces his own political challenges on immigration, one of his worst polling issues. His administration has been under growing pressure from Republicans and many Democrats to limit the entry of migrants along the southern border with Mexico, where migrants' apprehensions have reached record levels over the past 3 years. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump picked up the Texas governor's endorsement on Sunday, 19th of November, during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border town and promised that his hardline immigration policies in a second presidential term would make Greg Abbott's job much easier. "You'll be able to focus on other things in Texas," Trump told Abbott as they each appeared before a crowd of about 150 at an airport hangar in Edinburgh, Texas. Greg Abbott, a longtime ally and fellow border hawk, said he was proud to endorse the former president, who is the Republican Party's front-runner for the 2024 nomination. "We need a president who is going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said, speaking in a town that is about 30 miles from the Hidalgo port of entry, crossing with Mexico. "We need Donald Trump back as our president of the United States of America." Earlier, Trump served meals to Texas National Guard soldiers, troopers, and others who will be stationed at the border over Thanksgiving. Donald Trump and Greg Abbott handed out tacos, and the former president shook hands and posed for pictures. "What you do is incredible, and you want it to be done right," Donald Trump told them. Greg Abbott said about the Guard members and Texas troopers who are stationed at the border, he said, "They should not be here at this time. They should be at home." He said the only reason why they're here is because we have a president who is not securing our border. Donald Trump has been laying out immigration proposals that would mark a dramatic escalation of the approach he used in office and that drew alarms from civil rights activists and numerous court challengers. Though Trump has peppered campaign speeches with his immigration plans, he only made brief remarks in border country on Sunday. He spoke for only about 10 minutes against the backdrop of state police helicopters, a plane, and an armed patrol boat, all used by Texas at the border. Donald Trump wants to revive and expand his controversial travel ban, which initially targeted 7 Muslim-majority countries. Trump's initial executive order was fought all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld what Trump complained was a watered-down version that included travelers from North Korea and some Venezuelan officials. He also intends to begin new ideological screening for all immigrants, aiming to bar Christian-hating communists and Marxists and dangerous lunatics, haters, bigots and maniacs from entering the United States. "Those who come to join our country must love our country," he has said. Trump would target foreign nationals on college campuses and revoke the student visas of those who express anti-American or anti-Semitic views. He would also invoke the Alien Enemies Act to remove from the United States all known or suspected gang members and drug dealers. The law was used to justify internment camps during the Second World War. It allows the president to unilaterally detain and deport people who are not U.S. citizens. American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Texas Governor Greg Abbott officially endorsed former President Donald Trump for the GOP primary nomination at a Sunday event honoring service members stationed on the Texas-U-Mexico border. "Joe Biden is causing a potential terror threat in the United States of America," Greg Abbott said at the event. He added, "A president has one ultimate responsibility, and that's national security. Joe Biden has failed at national security. Well, I'm here to tell you that there is no way, no way that America can continue under the leadership of Joe Biden as our president." Greg Abbott added, "We need a president who's going to secure the border. We need a president who's going to restore law and order in the United States of America. not letting these criminals run ransack over the stores that you see images of almost nightly. We need a president who is going to restore world peace, as opposed to this outbreak of warfare under Joe Biden. We need Donald Trump back as our president. Greg Abbott, in his speech, also praised Donald Trump's border policies, including Title 42, building a border wall and eliminating the catch-and-release practices that allows immigrants caught in the United States without proper documents to be released from detention while their cases play out in courts of law.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A knockout. That is how Iran's leader described what Hamas has done to the Israeli regime. Now that a temporary humanitarian pause has been announced, Israeli failures in its war in Gaza are becoming more prominent, like how it has killed so many civilians, and how it was not able to achieve its stated goal, the eradication of Hamas. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the different ways that Israel has been defeated in this war so far, from the loss of the regime forces to their military equipment, and how the U.S. is also complicit in this war and is considered to have lost this battle against a group of resistance fighters. Let's find out what our guest thinks. Let me introduce them. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Ismail Patel, chairperson of Friends of Al-Aqsa, joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Elijah Magner, first over to you. So we have this temporary ceasefire pause. The regime has not achieved the goals that it has stated. And basically, from what we're looking at, it was forced to submit to the resistance terms, at this point releasing 150 Palestinian women and children. This has been cited to be a grand failure by Israel in terms of what has occurred. What are your views?
Thank you for having me. By saying that Israel has the intention to destroy Hamas and put an end to it, and then after 48 days engage into a negotiation indirectly with Hamas again to release all the captives and the Palestinian prisoners, it indicates that Israel recognizes the power of the resistance in Gaza and understand that all the initial objective to destroy Hamas and release all the captives by the meaning of force and military attack on Gaza is impossible to achieve. So we see how the Israelis, with all their wars against Lebanon or against the Palestinians throughout the decades, they have never managed to achieve the declared objectives from the first beginning of any military aggression or military operation. For that reason, we see today the Israelis understanding that in 48 days they have not managed to release one prisoner or one military personnel that was captive by Hamas or one civilians, and that they have to sit around the table and negotiate. Moreover, what turned the table against the Israelis is the attack of the Palestinian resistance inside Gaza from zero distance or from tens of meters, and it is every single day not only engaging with the Israeli occupation forces inside Gaza, but continuing to launch missiles against all the Israeli cities and villages. This is a great failure for Benjamin Netanyahu's government and even his small government that he thought by bringing Benny Gantz and the defense minister, they could achieve something.
Okay, well, some great points there made. Ismail Patel, I'm trying to understand how it is that Israel has reached this humanitarian pause or truce, but at the same time, they are still bombing. We understand in the Jabalia area, bombs have still dropped. We understand that the Al-Shifa Hospital, they are still there, and there are crimes that are being committed in that respect in the Gaza Strip just before this truce is going to come into effect. Isn't Israel digging its own grave by conducting itself that way?
In a way, I suppose the truce itself exposes the, if you use your metaphor, digging its own grave, because for Israel to have been successful in carrying out the atrocities on the Palestinians, it has also waged wars around the world. And what I mean by that is there's been a war on international law, there's a war on UN resolutions, a war on Geneva Conventions, and a war on humanity itself. And these little wars that are being fought around the world to undermine are the ones that are being exposed by the international community. And that is what made it so difficult for Israel to carry on with its unfolding genocide of Gaza. So, I mean, the duplicity, the hypocrisy of the West and its allies are now being exposed because of Israel's continuing relentless bombing of the people of Gaza. And the pause itself, I think what Israel will try and do is will try and capitalize to the very last minute. First and foremost is try and carry out as many killings as possible, hold their ground. And then, as they've already mentioned, that they will not allow the people who have moved from the north, who have now gone to the south, go back to their homes. So in effect, there is a possibility in the 4 days pause that we are getting that Israel might actually consolidate its position in that southern region of Gaza. So there is a concern there as well. But we shouldn't be fooled that this pause has come about because of a loss of international standing by Israel and the loss by its supporters in the West itself, who are now being more and more exposed to the hypocrisy and the duplicity.
Okay, well, let's talk about the international standing, since our guest there has mentioned that, Elijah Magnier. I mean, that has been a rather big factor when it comes to the genocide that was taking place, if you agree, in terms of not only the numbers of people that came out, the frequency that that happened, and to the degree that it happened in terms of the masses, the impact also on politicians of different countries, how some who may have had a positive view of Israel then turned against that. And then also taking a look at the fact that the standing itself was on rocky grounds, and now it has lost any legitimacy when it comes to the diplomatic aspect of it. We know that, I forget, it was 9 or 12 countries that have recalled their ambassadors, and up to 3 now that have cut diplomatic relations. So what is left of Israel on the international stage then?
Well, in my opinion, at the first beginning, when Israel started the attack on Gaza, it has informed the international community, including and above all the United States and its European allies, and that is the same Western club, that there are going to be casualties, there are going to be heavy civilian casualties, and they all agreed, regardless of the international law and the accusation of war crime that Israel is going to be accused of. And this matter of Geneva Convention, international law, war crime and crimes against humanity matter very little to Israel and its allies, because we've seen that with the Americans in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and in all Israeli previous wars, and Israel and all the rest of the Western club have never been accountable for all their actions. So what mattered the most is the time frame that Israel was given to end the occupation of Gaza. And the plan that the Israelis went forward with, dividing the north from the south and trying to occupy the north, failed to achieve these objectives after 48 days of fighting. And today they are still not in control of half of the north. Even we're talking about very small area of Gaza, and the failure of the Israeli army occupation forces to achieve its objectives forced the United States to look after its own elections that are forthcoming in the US, and all the rest of European nations to be confronted with a daily double standard and hypocrisy, like Josep Borrell, who suddenly he is saying he's not a lawyer when he's asked if Israel is committing war crime, but he became immediately a lawyer when he's asked if Hamas has committed a war crime. So this obvious double standard is today no longer a news that is shocking anybody. On the contrary, we've seen that in Ukraine, and we're seeing that today in Gaza. So I think, yes, social media put pressure. The axis of the resistance opening different fronts put pressure on the Americans, on the Israelis, and this is why the widening front on several multi-fronts, this is something that the Americans and the Israelis wanted to avoid, because the outcome was no longer sure, and the failure of Israel was very obvious.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, reflecting on the masses that turned out, Ismail Patel, I think that another defeat that Israel suffered, and this is to a very wide degree, is what happened on social media and how people came out and spoke against Israel, but also spoke for Palestine in the form and manner that they did. There were some who did not even know the depth of the conflict, and they got educated through social media. And there's so many things that came out of that, such as this one entry that is stuck in my mind, and seeing you, for some reason, it has now come for me to mention this to you. We're here. It says, young Americans are picking up the Quran to understand the resilience of Muslim Palestinians. So you can see that these are not the types of things that you would expect to maybe have come out, but that's where Israel has also lost. Tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll just give you an anecdote. Our last demonstration we had in London, where there was nearly a million people, I was just talking to a few people, and I spoke to a lady who came out for the first time, and she looked a little bit of sort of out of place. So I went up to her and asked her what she was doing there. And she told me that, you know, this is the first time I've come to a demonstration in my life. And she was quite elderly, older than myself. And she said, the reason I came out is because I was seeing our politicians saying these are hate marches, and there was so much atrocities on the television that I was seeing, and I couldn't match the two in my head. So I had to come and see it for myself. So you're very, very right that people are wanting to find out for themselves, and they're no longer one listening to their own politicians in Britain, in the case of Britain, or the mainstream media. So they're going to the social media. And in a way, that Israel is losing the social media war. The fact that a billionaire, pro-Israeli billionaire in America, has started a site called Facts for Peace, as the euphemism goes here, and he's collecting something like $50 million to fight what he's calling the PR war. So that is an indication of how far Israel is lagging behind on this. But this is also something very important for us to find to sort of mention, that this pause is actually coming at a time when America is going to be going on a five-day holiday of its own Thanksgiving, and a lot of people will be watching the television. And it is very telling that in America, what's happening now is that pro-Israeli adverts are now going to be playing on television screens again to play it on the media and to see if they can change the minds of the public. But that may be said, we should also remind ourselves that America and Britain and maybe a few countries in Europe do not constitute the world. The world is much a bigger place. And if you look around the world, I mean, I've had news from countries like Malawi, Fiji, Trinidad, Barbados. These are small, minor countries who are having demonstrations. Tens of thousands of people are coming out on the streets in support of Palestine. And these people had never before heard of Palestine or have never done anything for Palestine. Because, but they understand the colonialist nature of Israel, the oppression that is being taking place on the people of Gaza, and they want to have their say, and they want to change that dynamics. So yes, the price is very high price being paid by people in Gaza, but that price is also bringing the world society out and community to in defense of the people of Palestine against Israel, an apartheid colonial Israel.
Well, we have heard both of you talk about the U.S. in one form or another, and the war, also Lashon Magnier, and the pause that has occurred is also seen as a sign of the U.S. failure here in two respects. One, the fact that they were providing weapons and artillery on a daily basis, and we're looking at things such as precision-guided missiles, small-diameter bombs, 155-millimeter artillery shells, other munitions, and some of these other munitions are some that was not heard of which there's pictures of what I'm looking at, where it would basically do something similar to the white phosphorus bombs. So, and if you add to the fact that the U.S. is said to be complicit in the execution of the plans, because Joe Biden was in the war room, remember when the war was happening. He didn't accept the ceasefire weeks ago, but he's now saying this is the best news and is warmly receiving this ceasefire or humanitarian pause. What do you think of the way that now the U.S. is looking when it comes to this pause?
Generally speaking, in every war, the Americans are the one who supply weapons and money for Israel, because it is not possible to go to war without a supply of ammunition, a consistent supply of ammunition. We've seen that in the 2006 war. We've seen that also in 2014, the Israeli war on Gaza, and so on. Secondly, there is a huge economic hit on Israel from the very beginning of this war, where on the first day Israel has lost $13 billion. This is why the Americans rushed to supply Israel with $14.5 billion and all the other ammunition. Moreover, from day one, Biden is the one who stated the objectives of Israel in this war. And he said, we're not going to achieve a ceasefire unless Hamas is defeated. That was repeated by the British and the German and the French, all visitors who went to Israel to support it in its war against mainly the civilians, because we haven't seen them killing any of the Hamas militant in the last 48 days. So it is not an Israeli war. The Americans sent 2,000 Delta forces to Tel Aviv. They've sent special forces. They sent their carriers to the Middle East, and they were fully engaged, headed by a general, an American general, who fought in Fallujah and has experience in the war in Iraq. Therefore, we understand that the American was the first partner in this war and was trying to achieve some victory that America failed to achieve against the Russian in Ukraine. So it is not only a complicity of the Americans in this war, it's a first-hand participation, full support of intelligence, of troops, and above all, the Americans told us that they also have their drones above Gaza. So the participation of the Americans was on full scale, and they are, and they were, and they still are today, hand in hand with the Israelis, with all the responsibility of massacring 5,800 civilians, children and 3,900 women, and as a total, over 14,000 that have been killed in Gaza, with the responsibility of the Americans and the Israelis.
All right. We know that this is going to be a 40-day pause, and there are some chances given that this may actually extend. What is your reading into how this will transpire? Do you think, Ismail, that after the 4-day pause, we're going to see this extended and maybe eventually for it to lead to a stop completely or not?
Well, that is our hope. The pause itself is just the beginning, and obviously it's not the end. And we hope that there's not only a ceasefire, but the end to siege and occupation. And that's the final sort of our ambition and our hope for the people in the region. But unfortunately, Israel's track record does not hold well, and particularly with America and Britain supporting it to the tilt unquestionably. And that, I suppose, bodes pretty sad for us, that it is possible that the pause might be used by Israel as a means to regalvanize and target what is necessary and carry on with its sort of unfolding genocide of the people of Gaza. But also it could create a political rift within Israel, and there's something that is something we need to watch. What happens to Netanyahu with internal politics, whether the other political parties and the Israeli public say that they need to get rid of Netanyahu and create a political crisis within Israel. If that is possible, if that emerges, then we may see a prolonging of the ceasefire. But then the chances are we might get a more right-wing government in Israel, and things might get worse even, because it depends on what elections and what the promises are made. And whenever there is an election in Israel, the price is paid by the Palestinians, because whoever's coming in has to be seen as if they're stronger, more draconian than the previous leader. So yes, the pause is welcome, and particularly for the hungry and the dying and the much needed medication and fuel and oil that is required. But it also leaves a lot of unknowns. And I think it would be foolhardy to celebrate this, but to move cautiously. And whatever we can do is try and prolong this pause into a ceasefire and hopefully an end to siege.
This particular fact, I wanted to... I dismissed it as not being as important to discuss in our program tonight, Elijah Magnier. But I feel like maybe it is something that needs to be discussed because of the fact that there have been previous wars. And it's about how many headlines have read how Israel has battlefield tested weapons. And this war is no exception, where it said that through each war, there are certain weapons that are being tested. It refers to the Palestinians as guinea pigs. It refers to the war theater as a laboratory. And it talks about surgical killing machines. One of the things that it talks about, I'm sorry for me to sound graphic here, it refers to what's called the Israeli spike drone rocket, where it can be modified, where overall it basically punctures, I guess, metal and causes tissue to be torn from the flesh. Just one of many examples. And why am I bringing this up? Because the arms industries not only pick up on this, but arms sales go up to buy products, military equipment from Israel. I thought maybe it's just for this war, but it happens in every war, as if this is one of the goals. And this is something that goes under the radar, so to speak. It just puts a different angle to this whole war, doesn't it?
Indeed, in every single war, there is always an element of lesson to be drawn from the war, testing weapons and checking if all the plans were all well and what every army needs to learn from it. So today we don't have only the Israelis, but we have everybody looking at what's happening in Gaza and looking at the behavior of the resistance and the behavior of the Israeli army. Now, the Israeli occupation forces have, of course, the advantage of using all the latest technology and all the most modern weapons that given delivered by the Americans. And because of that, it is important to watch carefully and learn what's happening.
Thank you very much for that. Appreciate it, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Thank you, Ismail Patel, chairperson of the Friends of Al-Aqsa. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks so much for being with us. Until another program, from Miko Etawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdaa al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malawi.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed. that a divinely appointed imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. ¶¶